This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Wow, I get to interview my heroes every now and again, and this woman who's brilliant and brave and courageous and a truth teller is going to be our guest. She is a psychiatrist, and she was with Yale, and she was part of a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which was profound, and a clarion call, unfortunately, that was ignored. It's such an honor to welcome to our family officially Dr. Bandy Lee. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Before we dive into so many things, I would be remiss and criminal if I didn't ask you, can we talk a little bit about the Asian hate that's been going on and skyrocketing, and what are you seeing and feeling about it?
Yes. Well, I have, of course, tied it to the immediate origins, which have to do with Donald Trump, unfortunately, as well as the longer term causes, since I've been involved in violence prevention for at least 20 years. So I would first of all bring attention to the things that Donald Trump had done while he was the president. Let me read what I said in March of 2020, exactly a year ago. I said, the greatest risk factor of disease and death is not being considered, and that is Donald Trump. If he continues in this presidency, he is on course for having three main effects. First, he will make a deadly pandemic much worse. Second, he will stoke division between believers and unbelievers in his alternative reality. And third, he will vastly augment suffering, which he will direct into widespread violence by calling the novel coronavirus Chinese virus, simultaneously deflecting blame from himself and channeling the rage to new targets for attack. I just happened to have that quote on hand because I spoke for an Asian American group just earlier. And, of course, the presidency continued full term without repudiation or any reckoning of the violence he has incited. And Asian Americans have become victimized. The over 4,000 incidents of verbal and physical attacks, which is probably a gross underreporting since Asians tend to keep things inside and are not great reporters, had started immediately after his calling the novel coronavirus Chinese virus. In New York City alone, the attacks rose by 1,900%. So it's very directly connected. Longer term, it has to do with the cultural effects of structural violence. Structural violence meaning the inequalities in society that include economic inequality, racism, and sexism that directly translate into premature deaths and escalation of behavioral violence. So structural violence is the cause of more than 10 times the deaths of all suicides, homicides, civil strife, and wars combined year after year. And that is why it's called the deadliest form of violence, inequalities.
Wow. And that grows and is the enforcement arm of structural racism, correct?
That's right. Structural racism is a form of structural violence. And so in my scholarship on violence, which is my main area of specialty, all my studies of violence have pointed toward structural violence. And that is why I have studied more societal level conditions that fuel what manifests as individual violence. But it's merely that vulnerable individuals are pushed into violence. But violence itself is more a societal phenomenon, what I call a societal disorder.
Wow. And if we go back a little history for those who don't read their history, I see things like the 1924 Anti-Asian Immigration Bill. I see internment camps at the beginning after Pearl Harbor, but they didn't do it for Germans. I feel like the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I don't think they would have dropped that on a European nation, and on and on and on. Am I on the right course to tie all that history together?
Yes, absolutely. These kind of structurally embedded racism and distinction of different races as superior or inferior plays an unseen role that translates into vast levels of premature deaths, as I had mentioned.
And Dr. Lee, isn't America founded on all of this? It's slavery, it's genocidal land grabs, and the very structures of corporate capitalism that leave so many underfed or unfed, cast aside. We used to have children working in factories. We had to fight for that. We're still trying to get a living wage. Amazon has people defecating in paper bags because they can't take a break. Isn't the system itself, though painted brightly like a movie set or and it looks fun like Disney World, but in a sense, it's the most violent creature, and it causes almost unimaginable and incalculable trauma.
Yes, it is a violent culture. In terms of racism, it was a global phenomenon. It was the light-skin-colored people who started racism as a hierarchical concept, globally, that is. And our country happened to be founded on those, many of those ideas because of the timing of its founding. But it's also served as an example for the world through its civil rights movements and also embracing of immigrants and other races. It had been an example for the world. So there's been both the worst and the best. Around the time when I started consulting with the World Health Organization, which was the late 1990s and then early 2000s, the U.S. was leading in violence scholarship and prevention programming. That is why we were invited to Geneva. But now we have become, again, we have lapsed back into becoming more examples of violence rather than the antidote to violence.
Well said. And wasn't the election of Donald Trump and then his presidency basically a primal scream for all of this? And I would say came to a head at the violent insurrection?
Yes. Essentially, I considered his presidency a barometer of the state of our societal mental health. And I have always considered it a violent presidency. Most people did not go to that right away, but the kind of violent rhetoric he used, the fact that he boasted about sexual assaults, that he incited violence at his rallies, that he showed a great deal of attraction to violent policies and powerful weapons, and later taunting of allied and enemy nations, including nuclear powers. All of these pointed to violent tendencies, and not just the specific acts of violence, but he laid the groundwork for a culture of violence that would give rise to epidemics of violence in ways that would be very hard to do from any position other than his, having the most powerful and influential position as President of the United States. That is why I titled the collection of essays that I published, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, to bring attention to his dangers.
What does it say about us that our media glorified him, loved it, that he got them more viewership, raised their advertising rates, and everything you nailed and everything you outlined in the book and 200 things that are not there? To my mind, he not only got away with it, he took a whole lot of money with him, his family got rich, and so did all the grifters that were surrounded him. Of course, some of the yahoos that stormed the Capitol, they'll pay a price. But what does it say about us that he's basically, to this point, walked scot-free and got 74 million votes.
Yes. Well, I had warned that if we had a severely mentally impaired person in an influential position, that his symptoms would spread. The fact that we can tell that that his general strategy is not rationally planned, but rather pathological, is by the rate and ease with which his symptoms have spread, including what is now called the big lie, his fixed false beliefs about the election, about the pandemic being a hoax. All of these things have spread more rapidly because he was mentally impaired. So that's something that those who have practiced in mental health care settings would recognize and see, especially in public sector settings, where individuals go untreated for a long period of time and their symptoms worsen. It's not the healthy individuals who make the sick person better. It's rather the symptoms of the sick person that spread to secondary individuals, even healthy individuals, to the point where they look almost identical to the primary individual. It's a very impressive phenomenon that I have seen a number of times working with street gangs and families and households with schizophrenic individuals, for example, who often don't seek treatment and are severely impaired.
This literally sounds like it's something straight out of a Stephen King novel, like the zombie apocalypse. Yeah, your lap, but it does, doesn't it? Because it has spread like a virus. And then
yes.
I have been fascinated as an armchair guy. I went to the rallies. I would go where they were in their voting booths, you know, and talk to them. I was fascinated. And a couple neighbors, not to be cruel, but these people have detached themselves from reality.
Yes, exactly.
And they live in an alternative universe. And it's like they're glazed over. And if we were watching the movie series on Netflix, we would be glued and, you know, we might even laugh. But this is real life. And it's the same, right?
Yes, it's very much the same. That is why I had warned of shared psychosis from the very beginning. Shared psychosis, or folie à plusieurs, meaning madness by multiple, also called folie à millions when it affects a population. Essentially, it is kind of a hijacking of the mind. And it spreads very much like an infectious disease. It is actually considered a transmissible condition in mental health, very much like a virus. But you don't need physical exposure because it's not physically transmitted, but it transmits through emotional bonds, using emotional pressure. And that is what we have seen. Those who have been emotionally bonded to Donald Trump have more readily clung to his fabricated ideas, and it has had a powerful effect because it's actually coming from an individual who is highly impaired.
Has it blown you away, even with all your expertise? Is it still just defy law? I mean, when I'm around it, I just can't believe it.
What has surprised me is the lack of intervention, because it's the very first time that I have had a chance to witness all this unfold while there's no intervention. Because in the clinical setting, if we see this level of pathology, of course, something is done. And we never get to really test our predictions. In this case, our predictions came true every step of the way, by degree and by timing, without any deviation, to our dismay and surprise. But then again, he's not a hard person to figure out. He is, well, I've seen at least 1,000 individuals with his psychological structure in my work with violent offenders. And he is almost like an open book. Most psychiatrists would say they know more about him than any patient they have ever treated, because he's giving very unfiltered reports constantly, even his hourly thoughts, without much discipline and without much filtering. And we have decades of footage on him. So it's really a great deal of high quality information.
And he became the president of the United States. We're trapped in some sort of contextual field. It's just so strange. And it was a four-year traumatic event.
Yes, yes, indeed. It's not just that his followers were affected in their mental health by taking on his symptoms, but even those who tried to resist him and are grounded in reality still have been traumatized and exhausted and stressed to a level that surpasses every war that we've been in and every major incident in memory, according to an American Psychological Association study. So we've been having unprecedented injury to our psychological health.
I was going to say they literally tried to take over the country and declare martial law. And I was always afraid of a nuclear exchange.
Yes, that was important to keep our eyes on because it was always so close and so risky. And the consequences are just so severe that even if the probability was small, it warranted our constant vigilance. And essentially, he had no inhibitions or filters against his pushing the button if he wanted to, because we're always on hair trigger alert. I write about how that is a precarious situation for humankind to constantly be in, that it's inappropriate for any president. We have barely escaped a nuclear holocaust over a dozen times simply by the sheer chance of good fortune. But to add to that, mental instability of the person in command of the nuclear weapons and someone who is predisposed to psychological dangerousness, that he was actually attracted to nuclear weapons. This combination was extraordinarily dangerous, and it's still surreal that we have put ourselves in that situation for so long.
He's the first president in history that wanted to nuke both a hurricane and Iran.
Yes, and Europe was not out of the question.
And did you ever see the movie Dr. Strangelove? To me, I started to wonder if we were going to have that scenario.
Yes, I was recommended the film. I hope to see it someday.
Are we out of the woods yet, though? He's down there at Mar-a-Lago getting heavier and golfing, and now he's calling in the Fox.
Yes. No, we are not out of the woods. My fear has been that there would be no repudiation, no referendum on his dangerousness, his violent insurrection, or his mental unfitness. And that has actually continued, unfortunately. The two Senate acquittals of impeachment have been taken as victory, as exoneration by him and his followers. And so we really don't count other than to make us feel good. But there really has not been a curbing of actual behavior on his part or on the behavior of his emboldened imitators and followers, in that he opened the door to this level of criminality and mental unfitness to be allowed in elected office. And we see that at the Congress level, at local levels, all around the country. So something needs to be done fast, because we just have a short window of opportunity before it can exert itself into our culture and then further expand. Well, that has been the trend over the last couple decades, in that it has continued to expand, and without intervention or some kind of referendum, it has continued to expand its ways. And that is why many people have said that we're veering too close to fascism. Fascism, from my perspective, is not a political ideology, but mental pathology in politics, because it takes on the very characteristics of pathology rather than a usually life-affirming ideology that happens to be different. And it's very important to distinguish pathology from normal, informed, and rational decision-making, because once pathology takes over, as you described, it's almost like an infectious disease, and it affects the very faculties that would be able to recognize that something is wrong and to be able to get help. In fact, it will accelerate further and further into making decisions that plunge us further into pathology and destruction and self-annihilation eventually. So it's understandable that people made a mistake. The character pathology that Donald Trump brings often manipulates and hypnotizes the population, beguiles in ways that people could be drawn to him and make a mistake. But it was truly an error on the part, especially of the American Psychiatric Association, to silence all professionals from speaking about this and to be able to distinguish for the public what is pathology and what needs intervention and what does not belong in the political sphere.
I agree. And my dear friend, Dr. Alan Francis, one of the great psychiatrists of the last 100 years, who's been on the show countless times, he spoke out like you. He has been on fire because he just thinks too much is at stake.
Yes. Yes, we agree on the dangerousness of Donald Trump. And it is still a danger. And it's a danger that has not been curbed. To silence professionals and intellectuals, to silence expert voices, is just as dangerous as depriving the public from facts. So that's why we see in authoritarian regimes that the first people who are silenced are journalists and intellectuals. I've been teaching at Yale Law School for 15 years, where students represent political asylum seekers, and so we know of the conditions of many countries from around the world. And this is their responses are almost uniform. They persecute those who would speak the truth, because the truth is very threatening for those who wish to spread false beliefs and gain power.
Is the system not holding him accountable because the corporately owned and corrupt system at its heart would love fascism? Fascism is great for corporations. An obedient police state like China of consumers, very little civil or human rights, very little free speech, but you're welcome to go buy stuff. Is that too nefarious an imagining for me? Why is the system not holding him accountable?
Well, nowadays, oppression does not happen through secret police or imprisoning journalists, not so much in the first world. It is done through psychological manipulation, and that is how they are doing it. Is the corporate sponsorship involved? I believe so. I resigned from the American Psychiatric Association in 2007 when they started taking a third of its revenue from the pharmaceutical industry, and their policies directly changed as a result of that. The APA used to be quite a defender of patient rights, and I was quite involved. I admired their actions, was a fellow of the APA, and was active for about 10 years. But once they started accepting pharmaceutical industry money, they were advocating pharmaceuticals over patient interest and over the good of the public. And this time around, with the Trump presidency, they began issuing a gag order by reinterpreting what is called the Goldwater Rule. And namely, it says that you should not diagnose a public figure unless you have done an examination and have consent. Well, that's reasonable because we're not treating them. You don't usually diagnose, you cannot diagnose unless you have all medical records. But they changed that to any comment whatsoever, that we could not say anything that is objectively observable about a public figure unless we have examined them and gotten consent from them. Well, what does that do? It silences us, gags us from speaking about the very individuals who need to be spoken about to protect public health. So that was actually an alarming act on the part of the APA, and that's what started me in my public speaking up about the dangers of Donald Trump. And as I predicted, silencing expert voices would enable the pathology to spread and grow worse around the nation, and therefore worsen public health. And I actually attribute the 500,000 American deaths from COVID-19, which some studies show are up to 97% unnecessary. And of course, the violent insurrection and the near loss of our democracy, that we came very close to having a coup, and that would have been devastating for the country.
You were brave and courageous, and I also read a study 2 days ago that said 97% of the deaths could have been avoided. Look at the other countries. We had toxic leadership. Will you share what happened with you in Yale and what you said and why and the consequences, if you can?
Well, actually, I've been refraining from speaking about the lawsuit, so I cannot really talk about that. But as you know, there is a lawsuit. And I have been very fearful of the self-censorship and ready compliance with power at all costs, which has been happening throughout institutions. Why did the APA side with the president rather than with professional standards and public health, which is its responsibility? It is because of power. The CEO of the APA confessed that the APA modified the Goldwater Rule in order to protect its federal funding. And from what we can see from the APA boasting about its increases in federal funding, it's really unprecedented. And it has received windfalls of government money during a time when scientific organizations that did not toe the Trump administration's line were systematically, profoundly cut in funding, if not crippled. We see what happened to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which used to lead the world in curbing pandemics, preventing near pandemics, preventing epidemics from becoming a pandemic in the first place. It had to withdraw its China team months before the start of the coronavirus pandemic. And we do not know if this global pandemic may not have left China if the CDC team were kept in place. But rather than curb a pandemic for the world, it could not even roll out testing in a way that was functional for this country, and that's really unprecedented of the CDC. So the APA has been thriving. It moved its headquarters from Virginia to Washington, D.C., and it needs to be investigated. Just as the fact that I have been reproached for supposedly breaking the Goldwater Rule, which I have asserted I have not, since I've never diagnosed the president or his followers. I have described the phenomenon of shared psychosis, which is a national phenomenon and a societal phenomenon. So it's all encompassing, not about an individual. And yet one of the past presidents of the APA, Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, I think people should know his name because he's constantly trying to get himself a government job. But he himself has diagnosed the president in great detail, in fact, with insufficient information and faulty assumptions. He has totally excluded a whole list of diagnoses, which is diagnosis is done mostly by exclusion, and published a popular article just on this, and yet the APA has not spoken one word about him because his diagnosis was advantageous to the president. So it's us who have not violated the Goldwater rule as originally intended and called out the signs of danger and the need for an evaluation in order to protect public health. So we have a primary responsibility to society, just as we do to patients. So we have a primary duty to the public, and yet we are told, we have been called armchair psychiatrists, using psychiatry as a political tool and doing this for self-aggrandizing purposes. They're saying this about us without an examination or without consent is exactly in violation of their new Goldwater rule. But yet that doesn't matter because they're favoring power through this. And so I predicted in the very beginning that the APA's action of ceding professional authority to power was the first sign of authoritarianism. And that turned out to be the case. I also said at the time that if the president would not be held accountable for his mental unfitness, that he was unlikely to be held accountable for anything else. And that's been true. Not even for a violent insurrection that almost destroyed the country has he been held accountable. The Department of Justice also fell in line, just like the APA had. And so my predictions came true, unfortunately. Well, I'll just stop there if you have any other questions.
No, and everything you said for the listener is supported by fact. And basically, someone, I can name the attorney or I can just say not, but someone connected with the Trump and also Jeffrey Epstein and sued and very controversial figure with an agenda. He is the one who complained to Yale, and that's why they acted. And by the way, he's constantly commenting on cases and things he knows almost nothing about. He's on every channel, and that seems to be okay.
Yes.
Do you think if you were a white Anglo man and had done exactly what you did, that you still would have been fired?
I think the likelihood is much lower. I have written an article about whether the Goldwater Rule really has to do with white supremacy and male superiority, and I think that is true. It is about disproportionately favoring power and people in positions of power because it's internally inconsistent by logic, by science, or our modes of practice. And it has also gone as far as to stigmatize the entire mental health field by shutting it down, by declaring it the only medical specialty where experts cannot speak about it, and the only field where experts are not allowed to contribute to the public discussion. No other field has done that. And it declared this with the start of the Trump presidency. So it's stigmatize the entire mental health field as something you absolutely have to hush about. And it was not an organic decision on the part of the country to exclude mental health experts. I experienced it because 3 months after our runaway bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, it was such a bestseller that Macmillan, one of the top five publishers in the country, could not replenish stocks to the point where it wouldn't disappear in an hour or two until 5 weeks later. They just did not expect it. And I was invited by all the major news programs. I didn't accept all the invitations. Now I kind of regret that, but I was invited by all of them, not an exception, including Fox News. And the public was aligned. The Congress members had hope in us. I met with over 50 Congress members, and everything was aligned. And that was when the APA intervened and shut us down. So I have to constantly wonder, if the APA did not shut us down, the public experienced it as a switch turning off. But in the background, it was this artificial intervention. After which the APA saw windfall after windfall of federal funding, according to its own press releases, at the expense of a possible intervention that could have prevented all the calamities that followed. So I have great regrets how I might have done better, maybe if I had pushed forth a white male psychiatrist to speak instead of me, although I kept being invited as the editor of the book. At one point, we did raise the topic to the number one subject of conversation, of national conversation, and everything was aligned, and people expected, the Congress members expected, that they would be able to intervene. So here we are, much more behind than we were at the start of the Trump presidency. Mental health has become a field we pretend does not exist. Truth tellers and whistleblowers are the ones to be penalized and persecuted. And many have called me a whistleblower from the start.
Well, I bet you feel good, though, when you look in the mirror and when you sleep. And I think we're going to have to do another show, too, which will be based on what you're going to do with all the money you get from Yale when they settle.
Yes, of course, it's not about the money. And it's more a societal issue, in that this kind of conformity and compliance to injustice should not happen.
But you did the right thing, and that's all you can do. And if a toxic patriarchy, white supremacist society can't handle it, you still did the right thing. It's all you can do. What are you working on now in all your brilliance?
I have a return to societal mental health, which is truly my interest, that I happen to have to speak up about a president was really not my choice, but the circumstances that invaded my field of specialty. But now that at least we are out of the presidency, it's important to improve societal mental health. As I said, it's a very urgent issue. So the group that I have been leading, the World Mental Health Coalition, is now beginning a Truth and Reconciliation Forum, where we are holding a series of town halls. We started with racism, white supremacy, and societal mental health just a couple weeks ago with Dr. Cornel West, Dr. Wade Nobles, and others. And so we will just address topic by topic of what we consider the major and urgent topics that our nation needs to face.
That's so beautiful. And again, as I introduce you, you're one of my heroes because you're so strong. Put on your global species doctor hat. Given all the data that we see, the trajectories, the climate change, the denial, the viral zombiness of fascism and people, the systems, aren't we hurtling towards extinction? And without a major intervention, that's where we are going to end up?
Yes, absolutely. You have pinpointed it right there. In my textbook on violence, I bring a great deal of focus. I talk a great deal about our collective suicidal tendency. And that is exactly our tendency, the tendency of the human species, and how we are evolutionarily the first species to be at risk of its self-extinction. And that, of course, is not a healthy state. And that is why I feel it is a race against time. The Trump presidency was just one manifestation of that tendency towards self-annihilation. And I'm also working on a new book that will be a collection of essays as well, called One World or None. And this will focus on the importance of societal mental health collectively for humankind, and how this is a life or death issue.
Beautifully said. And if I'm channeling the earth and I'm talking to you and the listeners around the world, what if the earth said, but Dr. Lee, wouldn't I be much better off without this one viral cancer type of species so the rest of the species could flourish? I could regrow the forests, clear the oceans, give me a couple million years to clean things up, and then maybe recreate a more enlightened type of biped? What do you think?
Yes, that's right. That is very true. The crisis we're placing our planet in is just our habitat, not not the planet itself. The planet can always regenerate. But the goal is to bring our species more toward health, to be more life-affirming and productive for the planet as well, rather than destructive. And that is the path from pathology to health. And so being a healthcare provider, a healer, that is my task as a member of this species.
I love how unflinchingly honest you are, even in the really hard questions. It's like you have to be honest. It's like, will we go extinct? Yes. Would the Earth be better without us? Yes. No hesitation. In fact, all the data supports it.
Well, we first have to be truthful to ourselves to address the problem, and I believe that the problem can be addressed. I'm a very hopeful person in that way. I don't shy away from facing the problem, because facing the problem is the first step to solving it.
So true. What do you do to take care of yourself? Do you meditate or anything like that to stay peaceful?
Yes, I do a lot of meditating. I am actually a quiet, contemplative person, and I love to meditate. I paint, and I contemplate.
You have a real Zen vibe. It's almost like they bring the Zen queen in and just say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we don't change course, we're going to hit the mountain.
Yes, I'm also a fighter through my martial arts. And it actually does come from a Zen-like concentration. So it helps me.
That's beautiful. And have you always been interested in human being behavior and the human mind and people? I know I have. It's endlessly fascinating, good, bad, and the ugly.
Yes, I have wanted to be a doctor since I was a very little child because of my grandfather, who was the most famous internist in South Korea of his time, because he did so much work for the public good after their civil war and during a time of need. And he always thought that the medical profession had a societal responsibility in addition to treating individual patients. And so I take on a great deal of his philosophy. I was always interested in the human mind and in human beings. That's why I chose psychiatry.
That's beautiful. You sound a little bit like my friend, Dr. Paul Song, who also has Korean origins and has been on the show, and he does a lot of beautiful work in the world. I hope, will you come back? Because there's like a million things I'd love to ask, but I don't want to take too much time from you and work that's much more important. But this has just been a revelation, and I'm sure for a lot of people, it's just good to hear it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for giving me a voice in the midst of silence.
What inspiring words of wisdom do you have for the young women out there all over the world who have huge and beautiful dreams of their own in their heart? In our society, in our world, it's sad, but it's a masculine and world full of misogyny, and women have to fight harder. What would you say to our beautiful sisters around the world of all nations, creeds, and colors?
Well, I would say embrace your humanity in all its particularity and its universality, that we all belong and we are all part of a common humanity, and we will forever seek unity in diversity and unity, which is a state of health.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.